Hello and welcome to Wrestling and Everything Coast to Coast. This time with very special guest host this week, and that's Jonathan Schwartz from Slam Magazine and Benny Scala from Pro Wrestling Stories, right? Or no, Pro Wrestling?
Pro and Dan and Benny in the Ring.
And Dan and Benny in the Ring. I always get Pro Wrestling Stories and Pro Wrestling.
Pro Wrestling not, Post.
Post.
I've written for them as well. Up. So
yeah,
that would have been accurate.
And it is our absolute tremendous honor to be joined by the son and Facebook friend of mine, Travis Orndorff. Thank you so much for being here. I know that you have a busy schedule at times, and it's a Sunday night, and we're all, you know, at least I'm all footballed out from my 49ers' gigantic victory over Pittsburgh earlier, and I didn't even know what the hell the Jets were up to today. Are they?
Nothing.
They
play not until tomorrow.
That's Monday night. We'll see what Aaron Rodgers does in his debut, and not that this is a football show, but you know it's the premiere of football today for most of America. So, but I do want to say it's a tremendous honor to have you here, Travis, because your father was one of my all time favorite wrestlers. I absolutely loved everything your father did in the ring. He was just a sensation. He's maybe, when you talk about what wrestling is all about, your father, Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff, encompassed everything about it when you look at it. I mean, except for wearing a mask, which is one of the things that I'm a big, you know, masked wrestling guy. You know, I don't think your father ever wrestled.
Actually, he did come in to a match and pile drive Hulk Hogan with the kimchi mask on. And came out and then revealed it was him underneath the mask.
Ah, so it was like just for a couple of seconds.
Yeah, it might have been a couple of minutes. But just so you know, I'm from living here in Atlanta, and for the rest of the country, football started last weekend. Just so you know, we are in SEC country. College football is the only football. Everything else is secondary.
Sure. Here in the Bay, well, soon some of our teams out here in the Bay Area are going to wind up probably in the ACC and SEC, the way the college football is scrambling themselves around. Again, we could do a whole show on that and nothing on that. But we're here in San Francisco, it's much more of a pro town than a
right. No, I say that just obviously thinking of my father's college career, and I'll say it's, you know, I haven't done a podcast in a while just for some personal reasons. So you know, having the opportunity to speak with you guys was an honor of mine. So I'm glad to kind of fly in and fly out of this world every once in a while, and I appreciate the invite.
Wonderful. So, Benny, you have like a ton of questions. You've had Travis on your show, correct?
Absolutely. One of our better guests. And so, Travis, I want to go back in time to, and I wish I was a fly on the wall when your dad was at Hiro Matsuda's wrestling school, because, you know, Matsuda was known for, how do you say, maybe like separating the wheat from the chaff. And I have to believe, one of my favorite movies is My Cousin Vinny. And one of my favorite scenes is when he comes in to first meet Judge Chamberlain Howler, Fred Gwynn, and he gives him the book of Alabama court procedure, and he just drops it on the desk, and you could probably use it for weighted dips. It was so heavy, but you know, his response was, "Oh, that's it." And I can just imagine that you know Matsuda asked your dad to do 1,000 squats. And your dad did 1,000 squats, and then his response was, "What's next?"
Well, let me go ahead and I can tell you that story. So, is it okay if I take it just a little bit farther back in time, like maybe
your
a
show.
Week? Literally
it's your
seven.
Show, man. We're just here to ask questions.
I'm going back 7 days total. After my father got drafted to the Saints, my understanding was, you know, they did a lot of hazing back then, and some of it was like putting on women's dresses and dancing in front of the guys. I mean, it was a tougher world, and being embarrassed was not something my father was ever going to be a fan of or enjoy or embrace. So I know that time was really tough, and then he went over to the World League. And then, you know, he had said his last coach in college had really burned him out. And so my grandfather had worked for MetLife after the war. And so it was he had gone to work for my grandfather selling insurance. And I don't know exactly what he did, but I do know there was a lot of like, you know, cold calling and things of that nature back then and, you know, getting people together. Well, you know, at this point, it's a Saturday morning and my dad is obviously not doing well, probably about to get fired, or, you know, because of just not having, you know, really that skill set, I don't think, at the time, and certainly not the confidence. But he's sitting there with my grandfather, his father-in-law. And he looked at the screen and saw somebody wrestling, and he looked at my grandfather and said, I could do that. And my grandfather said, I'll make a call. And within a week, he's sitting there with Hiro Matsuda. And so what's funny is some of this I'm going to say is a little bit of lore of what I've heard. And it's sometimes, if you don't know anything about wrestling, I've come to realize separating from fact from fiction is very, very difficult, because it's somewhere in there. There's 100% truth, but I've seen stories of 10 people in the same room and gotten 12 different versions. I don't even know how you get there. So the numbers don't add up, but I will do the best I can. But to your point, I believe they had my dad come in. It was a Monday morning, and Hiro said, it was Hindu squats. He said, do 1,000 Hindu squats. And so that was something my dad did regularly anyway. Like, he would do, you know, nonstop 1,500. Well, what I was told happened is that day, and you can imagine, number one, my dad is completely motivated because he hates insurance. He's finally getting to be physical. And, you know, if there's one thing that is both our salvation and our curse, is if you give me, my father, the opportunity to prove ourselves, we will do it to a point of hurting ourselves, just to be able to say, I told you so, but kind of fulfill that expectation of proving ourselves. It's where we find our value in many ways. So my understanding is dad did, when he did his Hindu squats, he would actually leap forward about a foot. And then he would, you know, so he was constantly actually doing leaping Hindu squats. And my understanding is he went and did not stop. And finally, over 2,000, I've heard as high as 2,500, Hiro finally said, okay, you can stop. Now, that wasn't the end of that exercise, if you will, but it was the end of that day's version of it. But my understanding is, like, when he did that, the entire room just stopped at some point, because I don't think he was looking at anybody, and he just kept going. And so, you know, how many did he get up to? I don't know. I don't have the factual number, but it would not shock me if he did over 2,500 without stopping, because I've heard that number from other people before.
And his physique, you believe it when you saw how incredibly amazing shape he was in, and the high energy he always put into every match. And he never phoned it in. He was always giving 100%. Jonathan, do you have some questions for our guest tonight?
So with apologies to Benny, I'm going to leap ahead considerably in the timeline, if that's okay. One thing that I've always wondered is, so Paul Orndorff had that amazing early mid-80s WWF run, main eventing against Hulk Hogan on multiple loops. One of the first superstars that I'm aware of who they really were able to slot in whatever role they needed him, where he would go from heel to face to heel to face at a time where if you had one run in one capacity, it was a lot on that stage. I'm just kind of wondering, for, you know, being at home and understanding from, you know, other kids of pro wrestlers, depending on the extent to which they're smartened up to the business at what point, what it's like to kind of be in an environment where you go from your dad being, you know, by kids at school, admired and one day and hated the next, or hated one day and admired the next. I always kind of wondered how that would play out in real life for the people who are at home.
Well, I'm going to give you a couple of variables that I think are very unique to me to me that are going to frame my question or frame my answer. And that is, when my dad's fame was hitting those peaks, I was around 6 and 7 years old. So I was born in 78. So the majority of people that made a big deal about my father's relevance, his legacy, his life, was the people I saw at church, the people I saw when I went to my baseball games. It was the parents. It wasn't the kids, not for me at that point in time. So from 84 to 87, there was some animosity with kids, but I had gone to a very small private school, and it was very focused on education. I think at this point I had skipped a couple of grades, and so that world didn't really play itself out inside of a Montessori school, but it absolutely did at the baseball field. With that being said, it was impossible to avoid, because my last name is Orndorff. Sorry about that. So it was impossible.
We'll fix that in post.
No, okay, great. So it's impossible for me to have avoided his legacy at any point in time during my life. Because as soon as you heard my last name, there was no other association that anybody had ever had. So if they had heard that last name, they would say, are you related to? If my dad's name was Paul Smith, nobody would have had a clue what my life was like, nor would they have bothered me. So it's funny that when people bring it up, I think to myself, man, like Lacey, boss man's daughter, and I are friends, and you know, her version of her life is completely different from mine, simply because if she wanted to not be Big Boss Man's daughter, she could disappear. It was much more difficult for me. So there was an elevated expectation, or at least I felt it. I know I heard it a lot. But you would be surprised how many times, you know, like a 40-year-old looks at you when you're 6 or 7 years old and almost set the expectation you're going to follow in your father's footsteps. You know, and my dad's footsteps were only a size 12, but the rest of them was very, very large. So I wasn't worried about his shoes getting filled. It was everything else. And so I think what I would tell you is I was more disappointed in how many men that I interacted with really took it upon themselves to try to take advantage of me in many ways. They would ask for dad's address, or, you know, they might ask questions. And as a kid, I didn't know what I should or shouldn't say. You know, the only thing I knew was kayfabe meant shut the up. You know, if I heard kayfabe, then that shut up, Travis. And I went, oh, you know, it was literally like a pause button. But I would tell you that being around those adults and having those expectations, or I'm hearing those questions, it's kind of that expectation you're going to physically turn into something that is unattainable for 99.99 plus percent of everybody that's ever lived. And somehow you at 7 or 6 are going to be able to, you know, achieve this. And so when you think about it, it's funny how people really didn't have a boundary with me around the fact that I was a child. I can remember people promising me autographs of, like, they would ask me who my favorite athlete was, and I would, you know, they'd offer me an autograph, and I'm an innocent kid. I don't think much of it. And then it turns out, obviously, they were just trying to get information on my dad, or, you know, our home address. You know, we were always unlisted back in the day that you enlisted yourself. So, you know, growing up with it, it was so unique. And, one of my best friends, his name's Craig. Him and I have had this conversation. I will tell you, I learned how to become two different people, almost to the point that I lost track of which one I was. There was Paul Orndorff's son, and then there was Travis. Travis was really hard to live and be. Travis was hard to exist as. Being my dad's son was easy, because it didn't point out anything about me. All I had to do was talk about how much I loved dad, and everybody already agreed with it. And by the way, it was true. So as you start to go up through life, my identity got lost in Paul Orndorff's son for many, many, many years. And it didn't come from the kids I grew up with. It came from the adults I was around. And in many ways, in a very vulnerable and naive, you know, position. So I say that to say, the expectations that came out of that that got put on me, I don't know that I blame anybody else, because my dad felt the same way, might have come through that. I'm not pointing a finger, but I will tell you, it was very, very hard to figure out how to be me and happy when there was the idea I had to be him and something else, right?
Oh, that's fascinating, Travis. I mean, we've had a lot of children from wrestlers on the show over the years, and that's a very unique perspective, but well thought out, and you know, certainly something that I can see brings a lot of emotion within you, and that's because that's you know, Evan Ginsberg, who's also been on the show, you know, he was also a host of the show. He, and it's guest star every once in a while, he interviewed your dad for 350 days. And unfortunately, it was towards the end. He was not looking so great, which was, you know, another story for another time, I think. I don't even want to get into, you know, the end for him, because it was, I think, even for all of us who were fans of his, it was heart-wrenching.
Well, what I'll tell you is you don't know the whole story.
No,
and that has been by choice. Not because, and I'll say this, not by my choice at times, though I am grateful that I haven't gone any further into what people assume about me or the situation. But my father made me make him a promise a long time ago to not embarrass people. So the end was beyond difficult, and I appreciate and respect that you give me that space. But what I'll tell you is, there's no perfect way to end your life in any capacity. And when you love somebody as much as you do your parents, what you think you're going to be sad at the end, and that's going to be the trauma. But the trauma is the relief you have that they're not in pain. And that's a weird thing to live with.
So, I lost my, anyway. I'm sorry about that. I didn't want to get, let me think of something more positive, which is the pile driver. You know, the pile driver is probably your dad's version of it. And there's thousands of guys who've done pile drivers, but your dad did the greatest pile driver in the business. I still show it to people when I want to show somebody what the dictionary definition of a pile driver is. Always your dad. Always your dad's version. How proud was he that he used that as his finisher? And really, I don't think a lot of guys have used it correctly as a finisher since he stopped doing his version.
Well, a couple things. Number one, I never called it a pile driver. Maybe I'm a stupid one. I always called it his leaping pile driver. I always thought that was
that's what I thought the name was too.
It wasn't till, listen, I kind of stayed out of the wrestling world. It's got a really voodoo vibe sometimes. And I saw good and bad, and my dad, you know, truly wanted to keep me out of it. And that wasn't hard because of the industry I worked in. But I assumed people called his pile driver something completely different than everybody else's, because I've never seen anybody do what my dad does. Man, I'm not taking away from what they do. I'm not saying the other ones aren't good. I'm saying my dad's always was something totally unique to him that nobody could absolutely duplicate, which goes back to that place where he was. Dad always knew and has always said, you know, the foundation of your body was your legs. And his legs were like he did legs every time he went into the gym. I don't think people know that, but every time he went to the gym, he would do either leg extensions or hamstring curls, or he did calves, you know, almost every time. Like, there was just certain things. He was always doing legs. Leg day was every day in some capacity. So I think his that work ethic and his hips and all, like, the things you have to do a Hindu squat around your hips and your pelvic area, your actual core of your body, not your abs, but your core, and then his hamstrings and everything around, they were like tree trunks. So he had the ability from doing all those exercises to still get off the floor when he was holding different individuals. But he was two things that I think have always differentiated my dad in the ring, based on my experience of watching wrestling, based on everybody else's stories. Because most of the stories I know about guys getting hurt were always when somebody else was either hungover or high. It was always, you know, on the road, X amount of days, too many of this. Dad's arm got hurt that way, as I understand it. But my dad, as I understand it, and we've had some very, very honest conversations, I don't know of my time my dad ever went into the ring drunk or hungover. He had complete awareness. He had you had his undivided attention. Even if he wasn't paying attention to you, every single person in that place, he felt like he owed them. And every single thing he did was for somebody that was 70 rows back or the front row. He didn't care which one you were. He loved you the same. I think you saw that in the way he treated his fans throughout life, right? So his pile driver is completely separated in every capacity, and anybody that thinks different, I would have to have, like, I just, like, I don't get it. Like, the tombstone is the Undertaker's, right? So that's his unique way of doing it. But yeah, his strength and his agility, his sobriety, and his ability to understand what his job was, made those guys safe to do it because he could hold them in place. And then second, he knew when he moved his legs how much to move them so they didn't hit a certain way. There was guys he didn't leap with that were tiny. If you ever watch, he didn't, like, he would leap, but he didn't. You can see him in multiple ways adjust his pile driver for that individual. It doesn't look the same every time either. And he told me that was something he did intentionally based on how that person either straightened or moved. And his last injury was doing the pile driver, and the individual he was doing it to stiffened up and he moved so he didn't hit his neck. And then dad ended up breaking his neck because he adjusted his body. So that's the full answer to that pile driver, is from beginning to end, he did it different, but the way he did it also broke his neck. And that's what ultimately retired him permanently from wrestling.
Wow, I never knew the story. Benny, you got some more questions. You got a hand.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit. And I want to just to make a point here that your dad broke in, for all intents and purposes, right around mid-76, wrestling in Florida. But by the mid-April of 77, he's wrestling in Memphis, which in my mind was one of the premier territories as far as the quality of the wrestling and the storylines. And within 6 weeks, I think it was May 29th, 1977, he beats Jerry Lawler. And when you said the pile driver, that's the other person when, you know, they say, ask who the king of pile drivers is. Although I don't think there's any comparison. I think your dad is one and Lawler's a very distant number two. But he beat him for the Southern Heavyweight Championship before a sold out crowd at the Mid-South Coliseum. And I mean, your dad's in the business for like 10 months, and he's beating one of the greatest territory wrestlers in the country and winning one of the most prestigious territory titles in the country. And Jerry Jarrett.
You already beat me to it. That's what I was going to say. Do you know who Jerry Jarrett is?
Yeah, he didn't mess around. He wasn't going to put a belt on somebody unless he knew that they were going to draw some money. So, and I wrote down in my mind, Jarrett was the Montreal Expos of promoters. I don't know if you remember the Montreal Expos. They get all these great players, but then when it came time for free agency, they either couldn't or wouldn't pay him. And I'm thinking maybe your dad was one of those people that he liked wrestling there, but I heard the pay was pretty awful.
So the pay was bad. The best part of this, I'm so glad you actually asked this, Benny. I got to have this conversation with Jerry Jarrett last year.
Wow.
So, yes. So I was like, when you started talking, I was like, there's no way he's going to ask that, knowing that. So let me just start with, if you ever go back and look at my dad's hair prior to Memphis, he did not have that down the middle part. He got that from Jerry Jarrett. I will bet every dime I have that I looked at it. I was looking at Jerry and I went, oh my God, that's where my dad got his hair from. Because, you know, people get certain styles. He never had it. It was always parted on the side. You can see it throughout college. It was only when he started wrestling with Jerry that he changed his haircut. And the only reason I figured out is because I was sitting next to Jerry and I saw a picture of Jerry with my dad, like way back in the, I went, oh my, like it was like the sun or clouds had parted. There was just like an epiphany, right? So the story that Jerry told me that day was, you know, dad was working for, he was working as a mid card for Watts, right? And Jerry was watching him, and basically Jerry said, he walked up and said, you are like, you are wasting the most talented person you have on your roster. And he said, who is that? And he point, you know, obviously pointed to my dad. And he said, shortly after that, he was given a couple of matches and he got over and he popped. Now, it might not have been Watts. I might be wrong about the Watts name, but I know the promoter he was with, he left there after that and went to Jerry because Jerry promised him the title. And dad thought the money would be there and the title would be there. So that's what Jerry said to me last year when we were at StarCast of all places, and obviously short before he passed.
So, Jonathan, why don't I turn it back to you, and you can ask another one of your fabulous deep thought questions. Nothing too emotional, though. We don't want to make Travis afraid of coming back on the program again.
I'll try not to. Hopefully this is a happy one from your perspective. So Mr. Wonderful leaves WWF in 1988, and then he doesn't resurface for a couple of years until he turns up in WCW, has a really great run with Paul Roma as tag team champions, goes on to work with the next generation of talent at the Power Plant, has Frank, I don't know how he might have felt about it, but an entertaining and kind of silly angle with psychic Gary Spivey along the way, which I have to tell you kind of opened up a different side to the Mr. Wonderful, really intense, super athlete, take no BS character that we've been seeing to that point. But I wonder about those kind of intervening years. There were stories that kind of went around, certainly the PWI and the aftermags. There were obviously false rumors that he'd gotten sick or passed away even. There were stories that he'd opened up a bowling alley. What happened, and what was it like, I guess, having your dad home after being on the road for what must have been years and years and years?
That's a fabulous question. So it was okay, and I'll tell you the story that I understand it at. So dad was hurt at this point, right? His right arm was starting to have issues, and the surgeon recommended a surgery. Surgeries at that time were not nearly as common or popular, and a lot of this stuff, even how they, you know, dealt with the muscular structural, you know, kind of the aftermath. Dad's mentality was he didn't want a scar on his body. And I mean, he was that, like, it, to him, that scar was, you were literally tearing down everything he had ever built in his life. You were taking away his identity if you put a scar on his body. So instead of feeling the rejection of the fans, because it's not going to look exactly or do the same, he's hurting. Dad just quit showing up. And it was a mistake he made because Vince made him, you know, promised him he'd take care of him as long as dad didn't screw him over. And dad, out of fear, pain, rejection, whatever, quit showing up. He had already been in the process of starting a bowling center. and he had become a Christian, you know, a couple years prior. So there was a lot of conflict that he was dealing with from his faith and his lifestyle. And that, man, you guys just don't know what it's like on the road. I'm telling you, you just don't know what it's like. Good and bad, and most of it's bad. Especially for that many days in a row with people that aren't necessarily mentally healthy at the highest, you know, at the highest levels. So Dad gets hurt. He opens the bowling center, and it was a very odd experience. So, you know, it was the first time Dad took me to school, and I went to school and near the airport here in Atlanta in College Park, and so it was about a 35-minute drive. But Dad, when he was home, that was, he drove me to school, picked me up from school. Because of the distance and because of the different things that happened, and even when he would do some independent shows at that point, right? I got to be with him all the time. And it was probably, for me at least, the absolute best years we ever had together, because I think it was the happiest he really was and what he was doing and trying to accomplish during that period when he walked away from wrestling. I think wrestling had worn him out mentally, physically. Obviously he was hurt. And I'm not saying his heart wasn't in it, because I think it was, but when your body won't do what you want it to, it's hard to bring your whole heart or feel like you're getting the whole heart of the people back, because I think he was so afraid to disappoint. But I did have those experiences. We did do a little bit of hunting, fishing, and you know, I got to see a side of my dad most people would not believe, which is this sensitive, humble, tender-hearted, you know. Granted, when he came to my baseball games, which he's now all at, and you know, during my freshman year in high school, and he'd pull up in the back of his truck and put a picnic chair from our backyard in the back, he'd take off his shirt and he'd be tanning while watching my baseball game, right? So there's this weird intermix of my dad is still Mr. Wonderful, even if he had retired. But I got to spend 3 weeks with him in Australia and travel with him when I was 13. And there are just story after story of all that time that when Dad was home, it's not like he was out doing anything other than trying to spend time with me and the rest of the family. He was home. He wasn't going to different places in the country. And if he did wrestle, he generally brought me with him. So those were without question some of the most fun years, and maybe not the most stories I ever heard, but it certainly created a relationship where we had that time together that's when I knew was a good time for me to ask questions. And as I got older, he got more comfortable with some of the more prying questions I would ask. It was like that till you know, much later in life, where we had kind of figured out we knew everything we needed to know. But even on my 21st birthday, I had to beg him to take me to drink a beer. He had never told me anything about his, like, he never drank a beer at the house. I mean, he might have had a beer in front of me in my lifetime, but I don't recall it. And so that was even taking that step when I turned 21, which is, you know, 14 or 15 years removed from the bowling center, he still had this, you know, kind of control over the life he wanted and how he wanted to influence me.
That's also an amazing story. In fact, you said there were stories about being on the road that nobody knows about. Are there any of them that you would want to share with us, you know, on, you know, about what life was like and being on the road so much? Is definitely a big theme of Evan's 350 days, of course.
So let me, okay. Let me say it this way. I'm going to tell you about a personal experience as his son, right? So And I'm talking about that world of entertainment, right? Just kind of the access that people don't necessarily see, understand, or know about. And certainly it's not something they know about me unless I've had that one-on-one conversation with you. Because some of that stuff is quite, frankly, it's like you tell this stuff and people are like, oh, that's traumatic. And I was like, oh, it's supposed to be funny, you know? And so you realize like some of the things that you've gone through, which are normal to you and some of the peers I have that are wrestlers' kids, that's not normal society or the day-to-day function that people have. So when I was in middle school, I had an opportunity to pursue some acting and some different things. A friend of mine who I went to school with pursued that and went on to do very well. And so at that point in time, I think I was 13 or 14, but I asked Dad, could I pursue it? And he said, you can't pursue anything until you're 18 or 19 years of age. Like, I'm not going to argue with you. This isn't a discussion. End of story. So when I turned 18, I had gone to school, but I wanted to go to LA and see if I could, you know, see what it was about, take a crack at it, whatever you want to call it. So he calls up a friend of his that was a guy that used to take the wrestlers around, right? And so these guys that are kind of in that little world, they're all, we'll call them entrepreneurs. But you know, it's they're all just kind of from a different, just a cut from a different cloth, not in a bad way, just different. So I go out to LA. The guy picks me up. The first place we stop at after he picks me up in the car, and I'm 19, graduated from a small Christian school. First place he takes me to, he goes, we have to stop in here. I work here, and it looks like a dead alley, right? Anyway, we go in and it's a strip club and this guy's a recruiter for a magazine company that does nudes. And I'm like, I thought you were a mechanic. He's like, oh, I do that too. And I'm like, I don't think my dad knows this. And at this point, I'm freaked out. I'm 19 years old. This is day one in LA. Things and all things that my dad kind of like he would drip over the years, drip little stories here and there about things that happen. And then my imagination figured it out, right? Because he would give me enough, but he would only tell me enough that, you know, he felt comfortable and trustworthy. So there was this drip, right? But when you go out and you go from like an alley to that and you're seeing recruiting and crazy things go on and you're like, this is how people live out here? What is going on? So the next night, I go to auditions and the next day, do some different things. And the next night, he says, hey, I'm gonna take you to this bar. And I'm like, dude, I don't want to go where we went last night. And he's like, no, this is a normal bar. And I go in, I don't know who I'm gonna meet there. I don't know anybody. I'm literally 19 years old. And this guy picks me up from behind and like physically picks me up and puts me on the bar and he starts ordering shots. I have no idea what's going on. The guy I'm with, you know, staying with for these days is kind of laughing. Short version is it was the drummer from Guns N' Roses, and evidently I'd met him like 6 years before when we were going to Australia. He knew I was coming into town, and just like as soon as he saw, like I don't have the full understanding because obviously things happened that evening, but that was my second night in LA. And I met a lot of other famous people that evening from different walks of life that most people can't fathom, like what that contact and interaction is like. But you're seeing them in the real element, not how they portray themselves, not what everybody says, like the real deal. And shell shock is not the word. I mean, I just was not prepared at all. And I was there for a couple weeks and I called Dad. I was like, dude, I'm going to die. I need to go home. And I got on the red eye, and I came home, and that was that.
Well, at least you made it through the safety. Yep. We're a dog-friendly program, by the way. If you've got your dog, you can bring your dog on the show.
Oh, hold on one second. Hey, come here. Come on.
Stop running.
Come here, Eleanor. So, so I say that to say that, like, as a wrestler, as the kid of a wrestler, this is Eleanor.
Oh, adorable.
He's a miniature dachshund.
Oh, what a cute doggy. What's his name?
Her name's Eleanor.
Eleanor. What a cute little dog.
She's my sweetheart. So I say that, you know, like from that wrestling world, the access and the things that you have available to you are not, number one, they're not things you want to repeat. Like, I mean, like people are like, do you have stories? I'm like, I'm embarrassed. Like, those aren't, I get that they're entertaining, but you have to understand that was that rocked my world at 19 to be exposed to that, good or bad, whatever. I mean, it had an impact. And so when I have these different conversations with people, I'm surprised how many times I have to kind of reflect and think, oh, that wasn't healthy. That's not what normal people deal with. My baseline for crazy might be a little bit different than everybody else's. And, you know, being inside of wrestling, and, you know, there's the side that I learned how to drive a three on the tree on Steve Austin's truck when he went over to his house when I was 15 years old. There's the interactions I had with Rick Rude when, you know, he gave me his keys one time because he had brought it down the Jaguar and we all got to ride in it, but he let me drive it. And, you know, Rick Steiner came up. I mean, there's, and my interactions with them would be no different than with one of your dad's buddies. Like, you're there, they're cool, but it's not like you're going to go have dinner with them later on or anything like that. There's just a kind of a healthy relationship. They're your kid. And they did look out for me, like at those times, you know, telling stories, funny stories about dad and different things. So there was absolutely a relational level. But I have the version of wrestling that happened when I was in my dad's truck. And then I have the version of wrestling when I lived it in the rest of the world at WrestleMania 30 and seeing it from that perspective, from, you know, from all those different angles, from going into it or thinking I wanted to pursue it personally, as well as dad telling me, hey, let me tell you what this life is like. And I genuinely am grateful at many times that my father was such the man he was, because, you know, some of the legacy things that follow other people didn't follow him, which means I didn't have to deal with that either, right? I didn't have to explain, like, if anything I had to explain was why I was so small in comparison to dad, not why dad did what he did, right? So I'll end with this and say the traumatic part of that life, of living that life, never goes away until you figure out that what you experience in many cases wasn't okay, even if it was acceptable in that environment.
Fascinating. So we have time for another round of questions. One from Benny, one from Jonathan, and then, you know, we want to find out about you, Travis, and what sure. You're doing too, and any plugs that you have. But Benny, why don't I throw it back over to you?
Sure. So Travis, I heard something today that I had never heard before. I was actually in preparation for this interview. I was listening to a portion of a shoot interview from Greg Valentine. And besides the obvious love and affection he had for your dad or has for your dad, he was asked by the interviewer if your dad was considered as a backup for Andre for WrestleMania 3 in case Andre's health gave out. And Greg didn't know the answer to that. And I just want to, have you ever heard that? And I mean, honestly, as a fan, I think that would have worked great.
So Herb Abrams one time, I wonder how many people get to say that in their life. Herb Abrams one time was telling me a story about when he was supposed to go, Andre was supposed to sign with the UWF. In those early years, and Andre made the comment, you know, he doesn't sign contracts, he shakes hands. And so my understanding was that dad, they weren't positive. Sorry, my battery's getting low. I need to change, put this on. Okay. So when the opportunity came and that was then happening, my understanding was that Andre, they never could count on him. He would never say, I'll do it. They didn't know literally till the time that Terry went to pick him up if Andre was going to go along with it. So I think there was a lot of desperation and fear around that outcome. My understanding is dad was placed as the backup, even potentially as, and I don't know how true this is, but even potentially as a way to thwart if something went bad in that match. I have never gotten any proof of that. I have, like, that is partially what I've heard from people kind of inside that world. And that they just didn't know what Andre was going to do. And so it would have worked with my dad very easily. What you have to remember about that period of time that was so unique is how limited the shows were accessibly. Like they were still running it like a territory. Like they wrestled all over Connecticut, New Jersey, all those. He might wrestle Hulk Hogan 6 times and have the same match over and over. Even during those early years of WWF, that world was still existing, right? So Dad's name and recognition was there. But let's not kid ourselves. Andre the Giant was the first of anything like him in the history of really anything we had ever seen. He was so unique. So there's no question which one was the bigger draw, and for the reasons. I mean, he literally was in a good way, a freak. And the match would have been great if it was my dad. There's no question. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think either would work, but my understanding, and even Dad did not disagree when somebody was telling this story, was that Dad was there. If it went south, he could fix it. And they knew Dad would.
So, Jonathan, why don't we have you give your final one to him? Because again, I want to leave Travis enough time to plus I have one other very small question I want to ask Travis, but I want you to get in. Yours are always on like this level, and I've got something a lot more surface level.
No, I apologize. I don't mean to get philosophical.
I've been thinking that this is one of the top 5 interviews I've ever done. I was going to tell you after the show, but from what you've already told me, you've said stuff that I don't think we've ever had on the show, and it's been fascinating so far. But Jonathan, I'm sure you have another inquiring mind question.
So if it's okay, I'm going to piggyback too, because I don't know when I'm going to get another chance. Okay. The first one is, and I think this is a conversation that you and I might have had offline on social media, but I think it might be worth kind of surfacing since our often fellow co-hosts, Dr. Mike Leno and Evan Ginsberg, have brought it up on the show before. At one point, your dad winds up working for a short-lived federation called the AWF, which was run by a ultimately hapless promoter, Gordon Scazzari. There's a bit of a mystery going that has made the rounds about what happened to that title belt for the AWF. Around the same time, Paul Mr. Wonderful Orndorff appears on an infomercial alongside Hulk Hogan and a couple of other wrestlers. I think the Honky Tonk Man was involved.
Coco Beware was that Nintendo game that was horrible.
Exactly. But Paul Orndorff shows up with the belt that looks suspiciously like the one that had been used by the AWF. In the interest of squaring the circle and answering one of pro wrestling's great long-term mysteries, do you have any insight as to what happened with that belt? And I'll follow up with one more question after this, because frankly, I just want to know what it was like coming home after Mr. Wonderful kicked Vader's ass.
Okay.
But I'll leave that in flip-flops.
Yep. So you're the first person to ask that, Jonathan. Wow, aren't you a little sneaky? Oh man, are you Canadian? Because I know I should be. I'm just kidding. So, rumor has it that this promoter didn't pay Dad his money, and so Dad might have kept the belt. It was at the top of a closet for God only knows how long. And then I think my nephew has it. My nephew still has it. So he wanted it. I think my dad promised it to him or something. I don't remember. Anyway, it was at the house and I wanted to borrow it for something. For work. Oh, yeah, that's what I did. I did it for work. Like, we were trying to motivate people. So, like, I would bring the belt in. And if they, like, were number one in customer service, I'd give them this belt. And we took pictures of it and stuff. So, It was used as a work prop for a couple of years, until I didn't want, my nephew wanted it. I knew he did, so I made sure it made it back into his hands, so I didn't forget about it. But yes, I never knew who the dude was, but I know he didn't pay my dad, and that belt was around my house. In fact, I used it as a prop one year. I wore it to Halloween. With my dad's robe, and I put the belt on. So yeah, that was at the top of a closet or bottom of a closet for a good 20 years, it feels like.
And that brings me to one final question. That's the name Mr. Wonderful and the number one and the DERFUL on the back of the trunks. Whose idea was that?
So the story behind Mr. Wonderful, my dad had a couple of nicknames. One of them was, they called him Oscar, because Oscar the Grouch, he was so grouchy all the time. So if you know Brian Blair, dad's nickname for, in fact, it's so bad because I call these guys these names like I know them. I mean, I do know Brian very well because he was there the day I was born. And confirmation that at one point in time I had hair. But dad's nickname for him was Beeper. I don't know why his nickname is Beeper, but I didn't call him Brian for years until people started referring to him as Brian, and I had to respond back to them, because if he called, I'd be like, Beeper, you know, and hand the phone off to dad. So, in the early 80s, like 81, as dad was coming, because I have the Orndorff robes that he wore that just say Orndorff on the back, except for one of the red ones that got destroyed. But he was still wearing that robe, that red with the black, which just said Orndorff on the back. And there's a picture of him with Piper. And so the Mr. Wonderful, my understanding is that Afa and Sika coined the name Mr. Wonderful named that came up with the name for dad as they were just trying to sit in there thinking about it. My mom came up with the number Wonderful. So that was, and I don't remember, there was a reason why they did it, but I can't remember what it was in particular. But, there were so many people involved with that process. And I don't mean people like, you know, there was entertainer, you know, people in the back doing studio stuff. We're talking about, in my opinion, arguably the most underrated and unheard of name in wrestling that deserves to be in the Hall of Fame of every wrestling thing that has ever existed is Olivia, who made those robes. How she is not the most recognized name for all of those robes with, she was married to Mr. Wrestling too, you know, so there was that collaboration with Olivia, who was completely open and kind of understood that glamour and glitz of that world. Now, keep in mind, they go from territories to where, as dad's walking into the ring, so is Liberace. So they brought entertainment and made wrestling entertainment with that kind of flair and things that, I mean, it's every day that they throw fireworks. They didn't do that back then. Liberace was the fireworks when he came in for WrestleMania 1. Muhammad Ali was the fireworks as himself. So that pageantry and all those things, Olivia brought the heart out of those gimmicks and put them in the attire. And so between Afa Sika, mom, and Olivia, they put all of those things together, and dad just went out and did what dad did, which is, you know, rocking and rolling, huffing and puffing and kicking and getting. He didn't stop. And so Mr. Wonderful fit him. And I think it was easy for him to embrace because he was so proud of his body.
That's fantastic. So why don't you tell the fans what you're up to now? And then if people want to get a hold of you on social media, I know you've had some physical that you try, you know, setbacks recently, but you seem fine now, or at least you look good to me from Skype, you know.
Well, it's funny. If you don't mind my sharing, I'll share a couple of things just because they have been pretty evident. There is a term for that, Russell. And I'm just now getting to the point. I'm pretty comfortable with this. I'm on my seventh surgery in the last 11 years. And so people will see me and go, Travis, you look great. I suffer from chronic pain. My right arm was actually injured a little bit worse than Dad's. I don't know if you can see. I had my bicep came off, my tricep twisted over the bone. I won't go any further. Anyway, I have had shoulder, hand, wrist, two backs, a stomach, and I'm about to have one on my neck. I unfortunately had a really bad injury a decade ago, and it just kind of compiled up. And then last year, my core gave out. I'm fortunate that I had this injury. So I broke my arm. I'll tell y'all real quick since I know we're. So I broke my arm in 2013, but I already had an umbilical hernia surgery because something tore in my abs 2 years from before while I was working out. So then when I was working out, I had a bicep tear. And the next day I threw a softball. When I did, the bicep came off, the tricep twisted over the bone, the humerus bone, the head stayed in, and it ripped the rotator cuff and labrum. But it spiral fractured, and the bone fragments went through my radial nerve. So it left me paralyzed from the shoulder down. And I had 50 staples and a plate. And so they said I wouldn't get my bicep back. And then a couple years later, because I had wrist drop, so my hand just hung. So I actually moved all my finger tendons over to there. So my whole hand works up like this, but it doesn't work up top.
Oh, my God. So do you still play guitar?
Yeah, I mean, I have the picks I have because my hand is paralyzed mostly, like at the whole top. They clip on my thumb, so my left hand. I had to learn how to be left-handed, so I can't really do it great. But
wow.
So I had a back surgery in 2018, and then in last year I started having anxiety attacks. I didn't know what was wrong with me, and it turned out that I had a bunch of nerve damage in my spine. From the last surgery that didn't heal, and my body just wasn't processing the pain signal. So I ended up having a spinal fusion in January. But I am on disability from Bank of America. So I'm luckily, if I can heal in the next 3 years, I'm good. But yeah, that's kind of like what I was saying. That's why I'm kind of low key for the last 6 months and stuff, has just been dealing with all that BS.
Well, that's a tremendous amount of courage for you to go through all that. And
I lost 55 pounds last year before the fusion because they said if I didn't, I would never walk again. So I got down to 3% body fat.
Wow. That's
I'm absolutely shredded. Like, I kid you not, like Rick Rude shredded.
Well, maybe that's, your dad was a inspiration. For that, some of those workout routines.
Yeah, there's no doubt. We definitely have an intensity level. So let's kind of circle back. You can finish up with whatever question you want to ask. I don't know that we've done the path, and I'll go wherever it goes.
No, that's fine. In fact, we're at the end of the hour, which is unbelievable because there's still a million other questions that we all probably have. So we'd love to have you back on as a guest again on the show.
I'd be happy to. I'm sorry. I went off. I go off the rails sometimes. I ain't going to lie. I didn't take my attention deficit medicine today.
The best interviews we get are when people are real like this. And you're the most real of real interviews that I can ever say. Everyone's been genuine on the show, but you're so genuine that I got to give you a lot of credit for that. And I know it's hard to be upfront and honest. This is the first time you and I have ever talked together in person. We've talked social media for a while, but we've never actually, face to face talked like this. And you're very open, man. And I would be, I wish I could hang out with you all evening and hear even more stories and all this from you. But, unfortunately, I don't want to take from your time. And I know it's late on your side of the globe. So
it all works out, man.
Yeah, so tell other fans how they can get a hold of you through social media or however you'd like to be in contact with them, and then we'll wrap things up.
So, with all the things that have been going on with me on a personal side, I've kind of stepped away from the social media, and not kind of, I did step away from it. Tyler Elenick, who is a man, he's like a brother. He's a friend. He's the reason that we have the presence, or Dad has the legacy presence he does. So Tyler runs, you know, the Mr. Wonderful page on Instagram. Also the I guess it's X now, but you know, Twitter, it's PAU1 Orndorff. And we have Paul Orndorff, Mr. Wonderful Official, on Facebook. And Tyler runs those on a daily basis. And depending on what's going on, every once in a while, he'll shoot me a picture or something and go, hey, go respond to this. He knows what I like to respond to, which is usually like fans that have a good story, you know, or an individual that remembers something. So he keeps me grounded and available. And it's always good to have an opportunity to interact with people. But also it's been nice to be able to kind of hand off my dad's legacy to somebody else and not have to carry that, you know, that burden right now. And so I'm so grateful for Tyler and everything he's doing. And, you know, I do have a couple of personal pages on social media, but in all transparency, I really do it just to interact with people and to actually try to connect. So it's very rarely that I'll throw something on my post, and it's more likely that I'll instant message somebody that looks like maybe they're going through a rough time, or you know, they're in pain or they're hurting and just need to be heard. So my interactions on social media are typically nothing but the intent to either encourage, inspire, motivate, and also to be a place where I'm vulnerable to those that might need it and need to know, you know, what it's like. But that even though my father is who he is, that I have those same struggles individually with relationships and that. So that was what I enjoyed about doing the legacy pages originally. And then when I decided to step away from my health, I've continued to interact with those fans at a personal and individual level, just at a much smaller capacity. But I'm rebuilding. So with any luck in the next few years, I'll be bringing my own project to the world. And, you know, again, thank you so much for bringing me on and giving me the opportunity to talk about my father and my life.
Well, thank you so much. You've really been an amazing interview, and we really appreciate it so much. Thanks to Benny for coming out here and throwing a few questions out your way, and Jonathan getting some questions that we always wanted to know, what happened to the AWF belt. So, you know, I didn't even know about the AWF, so I'm glad that you brought that up.
Was that Jonathan, were they wrestling in Guam? Do you remember that?
No, that wasn't the Guam tour. That was based somewhere. I think it was ultimately they promoted a couple of shows in upstate New York.
Okay.
And they had the idea of running these shows in January, February in upstate New York and in the middle of a blizzard.
Okay.
Is the big show. And he'd contracted a lot of talent, your dad included. There were a lot of no shows between just the weather conditions, and it seems to be kind of the nature of the game when it comes to pro wrestling, and it didn't necessarily work out so well for him. And from what I'd heard, a lot of talent was kind of treated the way that your dad was. And one of those stories where nice guy, best of intentions, but then the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Disaster, yeah, disaster promotion. But there's so many more stories. There's thousands of other great stories, and we'd love to have you on again as a guest. So, you know, certainly best of health to you, and see you around on social media. Thank you, everyone, for being here this weekend, and we'll see everyone next week. Good night, everyone.